Today is March 16, 2023. I want to talk about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. I want to start by talking about this drone that was downed over the Black Sea. I want to go to liveuamap.com. This is a pro-Ukrainian live map. So you see this is Ukraine. In red is territory held and also claimed by Russia to be Russian territory. That includes Crimea, which has actually been Russian territory since a referendum in 2014. And this is where they're placing the incident, although we can't be sure exactly where it is. That's just where this particular live map is placing it. And what does it say? It says video of Russian Su-27 fighter jet colliding with MQ-9 drone as it attempts to spray fuel on it. View from the drone's camera shows two passes by Russian jets. And indeed, when you look at the footage, you are going to see these two Russian warplanes flying very close to the drone, and one of them does eventually make contact, most likely accidentally. This really isn't something you could do on purpose without damaging your aircraft, and you could damage it in a very unpredictable way. There's no predictable way to make contact with a spinning propeller regarding the resulting damage. So it was most likely an accident, but they were most certainly there to intercept the drone and to disrupt it. The United States claims that this is being done in international airspace. But what the drone is actually doing in international airspace, I think, matters. The United States, the self-proclaimed leader of this international rules-based order, has predicated much of its military aggression around the world, not just in international airspace and waters, but also in the sovereign territory of other nations, predicated on upholding U.S. interests, not even national security concerns, just U.S. interests. In this case, the United States admits that it is collecting intelligence and passing it to Ukraine. A lot of this is done by U.S. satellites, but it's also in part done by drones exactly like this. And when you think about it, collecting intelligence is a key role of an army in the middle of an armed conflict. They are carrying out this role on behalf of Ukraine. They are participating in the conflict, collecting intelligence about your opponent. That is part of the conflict. The U.S. is doing that for Ukraine. They are a participant in this conflict. This drone was participating in the conflict when these Russian warplanes intercepted it. It was not an innocent passage. Now, it crashed somewhere in the Black Sea. The U.S. does not have naval vessels in the Black Sea. They will not be able to recover the drone. Russia may recover the drone. And this is a huge irony because if you remember back to fall of last year, there was talk about the U.S. sending drones like the MQ-9 Reaper or the Grey Eagle, very similar, sending that to Ukraine to use because they had a dwindling number of Bayraktar TB2 drones, which were being wiped out by Russian air defense and military aviation. There's this Politico article, technology concerns imperil Grey Eagle drone transfer to Ukraine, and it says, the biggest concern now is that Russia could capture one or more of the drones and steal the technologies. There's also fear the platform itself isn't survivable in Ukraine's grueling war, namely due to Russia's air defenses and numbers of missiles and rockets streaking across Ukrainian skies. And I guess you could add to the list of threats these drones will face are warplanes coming in close proximity, dumping fuel on them and clipping their propellers. I think in many ways, this represents a little bit of America's longstanding impunity falling into the Black Sea. The U.S. Has spread its military out all across the globe, and it does whatever it wants, wherever it wants. And this is part of the process of pushing back against this, establishing red lines in regards to the United States' participation in this proxy war it is waging against Russia through Ukraine. I want to repeat again that collecting intelligence is a key role performed during an armed conflict. The United States is doing this on Ukraine's behalf. They are a participant in the conflict. And this is why Russia intercepted this drone. And I just want to show you the disconnect here. I want to show you this from the U.S. Department of Defense. This was just yesterday, March 15th. This was Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Army General Mark Milley. This was a press conference following the Ukraine Defense Contact Group virtual meeting. And this is what General Milley said about this incident. He says, "The fact that we operate in proximity to each other is not particularly unusual, and we do try to establish deconfliction channels in order to make sure that our forces are physically separated and we don't have incidents like this. But there's a pattern of behavior recently where there's a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We think we haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well. So there's a pattern of behavior going on here, and we have to figure out exactly what the way ahead is." And I think the best way for them to figure out the way ahead would be to think about how they themselves would react if Russian or Chinese drones were coming this close to the United States, gathering information and then passing it to a hostile party engaged in armed warfare with the United States. How would they feel about that? And then they could use that to kind of shape their policy in regards to these drone flights that they are carrying out as part of this proxy war. They also talk about Bakhmut because they open the floor to questions from the media, and the media is asking about Bakhmut. And Secretary Austin claims that Bakhmut is largely symbolic, but we've gone over this many times before. Maybe it'll be useful to go back to the map. So if we look along the line of contact, again, the Dnieper River here forms the westernmost edge of the line of contact. That is a natural defense barrier that Ukraine is unlikely to cross. They're most likely going to launch their spring offensive. Well, people are suggesting they're going to launch their spring offensive in the Zaporozhye area to try to cut this land bridge between Crimea and the rest of Russia. And then, of course, all along the line of contact in the Donbas region, there's fighting from Vugledar to Avdiivka, right outside Donetsk City. You can see an encirclement developing here. And up here is Bakhmut, where Russia holds half of the city already, and they are in the process of encircling the rest of it. They're also kind of in the process of encircling Kassiv Yar, which is the fallback position for many of the Ukrainian forces leaving Bakhmut. And then, of course, we can see Russia continuing to spread out from Soledar in all directions, including north towards Seversk, which is one of the last fortified cities along this defensive line. And then there's the Oskol River and Ukrainian forces in this area in between the river and the Russian lines of defense. And that is the line of contact. Bakhmut is a pivotal battle because Ukraine has openly, politically committed itself to defending it to the very last moment. And to do this, they are committing huge numbers of men and equipment. And the question really is, what is the quality of these soldiers and this equipment? Are they diverting trained manpower and equipment that they were supposed to use for their upcoming spring offensive? That is the question. That is something we have to constantly read reports to figure out. Secretary Austin, when asked about this, whether or not Ukraine is pulling forces and equipment away from their offensive preparations and sending it to Bakhmut, he claims, "We're generating combat power to a degree that we believe that it will provide them opportunities to change the dynamics on the battlefield at some point going forward." Very vague and unconvincing. And to add to that, maybe we should take a look at this Washington Post article. Relatively recent, March 13th, 2023. "Ukraine short of skilled troops and munitions as losses, pessimism grow." Does that sound like enough manpower and equipment is being generated to not only hold Bakhmut but also carry out this offensive? I don't think that it does. And let's see what the Washington Post has to say. "The quality of Ukraine's military force, once considered a substantial advantage over Russia has been degraded by a year of casualties that have taken many of the most experienced fighters off the battlefield, leading some Ukrainian officials to question Kiev's readiness to mount a much-anticipated spring offensive. So this directly contradicts what Secretary Austin was saying during that press briefing, and also General Milley. The Washington Post continues. It says U.S. and European officials have estimated that as many as 120,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed or wounded since the start of Russia's invasion early last year, compared with about 200,000 on the Russian side, which has a much larger military and roughly triple the population from which to draw conscripts. But as I've pointed out many times before, and as even pro-Ukrainian sources now, like this from the Kiev Independent, public data suggests over 16,000 Russian soldiers have been killed during the first year of all-out war. This is from March 4th, so just earlier this month. So 16,000 Russian dead. This is according to a BBC and Media Zona ongoing investigation analysis and count. That is a far cry from 200,000 casualties being claimed by U.S. officials. As a matter of fact, considering that the U.S. itself is admitting that Ukraine is suffering over 100,000, almost 200,000 casualties, it seems to suggest that there's a ratio of 1 to 10, one Russian soldier for every 10 Ukrainian soldiers who perish in this conflict. Again, when you look at what the Pentagon is admitting to regarding Ukrainian losses and this investigation by the BBC and Media Zona into Russian losses, because when they say 200,000 Russian losses, they never qualify it. They never substantiate it with any evidence. They don't explain it. And when you read this article from the Washington Post and you look at what they're claiming is going on the battlefield, there really is no way that the Ukrainian military is in this shape and following this trajectory and still somehow inflicting more losses on Russia than they themselves are suffering. It's just simply, it's impossible. So there's a 10-to-1 ratio in Russia's favor, and Russia has said from the beginning this is about demilitarization. It's not about taking territory. This is a war of attrition, and the numbers are and have been working in Russia's favor all along. The Washington Post continues. It says, an influx of inexperienced draftees brought in to plug the losses has changed the profile of the Ukrainian force, which is also suffering from basic shortages of ammunition, including artillery shells and mortar bombs, according to military personnel in the field. The most valuable thing in war is combat experience, said a battalion commander in the 46th Air Assault Brigade, who is being identified only by his call sign Kupol, in keeping with Ukrainian military protocol. A soldier who has survived 6 months of combat and a soldier who came from a firing range are two different soldiers. It's heaven and earth. And there are only a few soldiers with combat experience, Kupol added. Unfortunately, they are all already dead or wounded. And I was just listening to this podcast episode by War on the Rocks, How to Think About Bakhmut and a Ukrainian Spring Offensive, and it features Michael Kaufman. He's a Ukrainian-born, U.S.-based analyst over at the Center for Naval Analyses. This is funded by the U.S. government, by the way. And he's talking about how all of the troops, the Ukrainian troops trained by NATO over the last 8 or 9 years, they are mostly gone. They are dead or injured to an extent where they are no longer able to fight. The vast majority of them are gone. So that is very grim, and the Washington Post even says, such grim assessments has spread a palpable, if mostly unspoken, pessimism from the front lines to corridors of power in Kiev, the capital. An inability by Ukraine to execute a much-hyped counteroffensive would fuel new criticism that the United States and its European allies waited too long until the force had already deteriorated to deepen training programs and provide armored fighting vehicles, including Bradleys and Leopard battle tanks. And as I've explained many times before, these are things that take years to do. So there was no way, even if the U.S. from the very beginning, February last year, if they began deepening these training programs and preparing to send tanks, It would never have been done in time because it takes years to integrate. I was just talking about the Bayraktar TB2 drones that Ukraine used to have. They don't have any more because it did them no good. Took them years, 2 or 3 years, for them to integrate just that into their fighting capabilities, and it still did them no good. So what about something much more sophisticated, like a tank that requires, for a Western main battle tank, 4 crew members who have to not only coordinate their actions together to operate just that individual vehicle, but they have to work together as a platoon, a company, a battalion, and a brigade. Not going to happen, not in that time frame. The Washington Post goes on and says the situation on the battlefield now may not reflect a full picture of Ukraine's forces because Kiev is training troops for the coming offensives separately and deliberately holding them back from current fighting, including the defense of Bakhmut, a U.S. official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity to be candid. What kind of training are those soldiers separate from what's going on the battlefield? What kind of training are they getting? Because Ukraine was doing this ahead of the Kharkov and Kherson offensive. And if we're talking about how experienced soldiers are mostly dead or injured, who are these soldiers that are preparing for this offensive? What kind of training are they getting? If they're only getting a couple of weeks of training on their Bradleys, Marauders, Challengers, Leopard 1s, Leopard 2s, all of these T-72 derivatives that are being sent, Strykers, all of these French light tanks that are going, they are not going to have nearly enough time to effectively operate them just individually on the battlefield. They'll be able to move them on the battlefield, fire their main weapons, but they're not going to be able to coordinate effectively. It's going to be as bad or worse than the Kharkov or Kherson offensives because now they're operating equipment that they are not familiar with. During Kharkov and Kherson, they were still operating Soviet-era equipment that they had years and years of experience operating, maintaining, sustaining on the battlefield. When they start using these vehicles on the battlefield because they're not getting enough training, when things start to go wrong, when things start to break down, they're not going to have the experience or the resources there to fix it, to remedy it. It's going to have to be sent back to Poland. So that's 1,000 kilometers from the front line to Poland and then another 1,000 kilometers back. And all that time it's in transit, it's in the workshop being repaired and then in transit on its way back. It's not on the battlefield performing its task. And everything that the West has pledged to Ukraine is entirely too few to make the difference that needs to be made in order for this to change in Ukraine's favor. And then the fact that a lot of these are going to be broken down and in transit or in a workshop in Poland is going to make it just that much worse. Then the Washington Post tries to level this out because it's quite pessimistic for Ukraine. The situation for Russia may be worse. During a NATO meeting last month, UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said that 97% of Russia's army was already deployed in Ukraine and that Moscow was suffering First World War levels of attrition. But we can go and read the BBC, state media from the UK, where Ben Wallace is the defense minister, and you can see that they're only counting 16,000 Russian losses confirmed. So this is war propaganda that they are using to try to cover up how bad things actually are so that they can push this forward a little bit further. Then the article goes on and it's talking about Kopol, this battalion commander that they mentioned earlier, and it says, he was speaking out in hopes of securing better training for Ukrainian forces from Washington and that he hopes Ukrainian troops being held back for a coming counteroffensive will have more success than the inexperienced soldiers now manning the front lines under his command. There's always belief in a miracle, he said. Either it will be a massacre and corpses or it's going to be a professional counteroffensive. There are two options. There will be a counteroffensive either way. And if you watch Garland Nixon during his live stream go over this particular Washington Post article, he said that hope ain't a plan. And a miracle is what you're praying for when you don't actually have a plan. And I'll put the link to that video in the video description below. And he makes a very good point. And we hear more of this talk, not just from a desperate commander on the front line, but we're hearing this from policymakers. and officials among Western governments talking like this. This battalion commander wishing for better training from Washington, training takes time, and it's time that Ukraine doesn't have. They simply don't have time. And I'm going to get into this training here in just a little bit here. Before that, I want to talk about what the Washington Post has to say about his particular battalion. So he says, his unit withdrew from Soledar in eastern Ukraine in the winter after being surrounded by Russian forces who later captured the city. Kupol recalled how hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers in units fighting alongside his battalion simply abandoned their positions, even as fighters from Russia's Wagner mercenary group pressed ahead. After a year of war, Kupol, a lieutenant colonel, said his battalion is unrecognizable. Of the 500 soldiers, roughly 100 were killed in action and another 400 wounded. That's 100%, they say, leading to complete turnover. That's 100% casualties. Kupol said he was the sole military professional in the battalion, and he described the struggle of leading a unit composed entirely of inexperienced troops. So when you're reading this from the Washington Post, it makes perfect sense why Russia is encircling Bakhmut, taking Soledar. It makes perfect sense why that's all happening versus the stories that we're hearing elsewhere about human wave attacks by Wagner simply overwhelming Ukrainian troops fighting. The Ukrainian troops have no experience. They have, well, we'll get into this also, no weapons and ammunition. This is why they're falling back. This is the problem. Washington Post goes on and it says, Britain is also training Ukrainian recruits, including about 10,000 last year, with another 20,000 expected this year. The European Union has said it will train 30,000 Ukrainians in 2023. So over the entire year, about 50,000 troops will be trained. In less than half a year, that's what it'll take for all of those troops to be wiped out. So they're not even training them at a level that will replace their losses. And we've gone over the training program that they're getting. It's just a couple of weeks long. It's a crash course. It doesn't even qualify as basic training for, say, the U.S. Army or U.S. Marines. And that's not even counting additional combat training or infantry training. What they're describing is a problem that has no solution. And they do not have the time to train up troops that can turn the tide. They don't. They simply don't have the time. They're giving these troops these crash courses and they're sending them to die on the battlefield. No amount of weapons or ammunition that you give to troops who simply aren't properly trained is going to make any difference. But the problem is they don't even have any weapons or ammunition either. This is something else that they talk about. So this battalion commander describes severe ammunition shortages, including a lack of simple mortar bombs and grenades for US-made Mark 19s. The Mark 19 is a 40 millimeter automatic grenade launcher. You can put it on a tripod and fire it on the ground, or you can mount it on a vehicle, just to give you an idea of what they're talking about. So this is a relatively simple weapon system that they are running out of ammunition for, saying nothing of artillery and other much larger and more sophisticated weapon systems. It continues, Ukraine has also faced an acute shortage of artillery shells, which Washington and its allies have scrambled to address, with discussions about how to shore up Ukrainian stocks dominating daily meetings on the war at the White House National Security Council. Washington's efforts have kept Ukraine fighting, but use rates are very high and scarcity persists. Russia is also facing ammunition, manpower, and motivation problems, and has notched only incremental gains in recent months despite the strained state of Ukraine's force. As bad as Ukraine's losses are, Russia's are worse, U.S. officials said. But we know that that's a lie because we've gone over the actual breakdown of these numbers. Ukraine is actually losing these huge numbers of troops. Russia is losing a large number of troops, but nowhere near. It's a 10-to-1 ratio in Russia's favor. And in terms of ammunition, every article that I've read from the Western media talks about how lopsided and how much more intense Russian artillery fire is to what Ukraine can answer back with. So again, it's just war propaganda to make it seem that it's not as bleak. Maybe Ukraine still has a chance, so they should just keep pushing forward, because the U.S. really doesn't know how to end this. They can't just say, well, they lost and we should end this. They want to push it for as long as possible and for as long as profitable, maybe get a couple more contracts on the books before all of this collapses. When they talk about Russia's incremental gains, it's Russia approaching this incrementally and not trying to grab huge swaths of territory out in the open like Ukraine has been trying to do. That's the reason why they're conserving their combat power. That's why they are wiping out many more Ukrainian troops and their equipment than they themselves are losing. That is the whole point of fighting it this way, so that they can maintain their combat potential while they eliminate Ukraine's. That is exactly what the Washington Post is telling us is happening. People reading the Washington Post now, reading this article now, might still have the sense that there's some hope. Look, things are even worse for Russia, so there's still some hope there. But they're not going to think about how drastically the whole narrative has shifted from Ukraine, a military being bolstered by Western military support, its army getting bigger. It's going to be bigger now than it was when the special military operation began. And they're fighting this deteriorating, incompetent, and crumbling Russian military. The narrative has been slowly turning around until it's almost virtually the exact opposite, where Russian military is getting stronger. They mobilized 350,000 additional troops. They brought them in. They haven't even been committed to the fighting yet. They're bringing in all of these tanks. They're expanding artillery shell production. Their artillery shell production was, from the very beginning, larger than the West's. So all of these things indicate a Russian military gradually getting stronger, while they are admitting the Ukrainian military is falling apart. And it is specifically because Russia is fighting a war of attrition, focused on eliminating Ukrainian troops and equipment, not on seizing territory. They will take territory, but the priority is this ratio, maintaining this ratio. And if a counteroffensive is launched at Bakhmut and Russian commanders feel that they may lose large numbers of Russian troops or large amounts of equipment, if they might be encircled, they will withdraw, because their goal is to maintain that ratio. That ratio is what is causing this catastrophe, this catastrophic collapse of Ukraine's fighting capacity that we're watching unfold in slow motion. So these are all things to keep in mind and keep an eye on. I would say this situation around Bakhmut, the way that it develops, is going to give us clues about just how much Ukraine does have held in reserve for this counteroffensive. Since we don't know the disposition of Russian or Ukrainian troops for certain, we should make no assumptions. We should not assume that Ukraine does not have the ability to carry out a very significant spring offensive or even a significant offensive in and around Bakhmut. But when they do carry it out, how it unfolds is going to give us clues about Ukrainian and Russian troop disposition. So these are things we have to keep an eye on. And also this escalation between the U.S. and Russia directly, as Russia starts establishing red lines, constraining America's incremental approach to gradually getting itself more directly involved in what is still more or less their proxy war against Russia through Ukraine. So if you thought this video was useful, please like and share. Think about subscribing. It's free to do. It helps the channel grow. Check the video description below for other places you can find and follow my work. I've also listed all of the links that I referenced in this video. There are also ways in the video description below where you can help support my work. I don't monetize my YouTube channel. If an ad pops up, feel free to skip it, because it's not helping me out at all. If you do want to help support my work, please do so through Buy Me a Coffee and also Patreon. And to everyone who has been helping out, whether it's one-time donations, month-to-month donations, or even if you're just helping share my work with others, I greatly appreciate all of that. That all helps tremendously. It's what makes this work possible. So thank you again, and as always, thank you for watching.